If anybody were to tell you that they belonged to a Presbyterian church, that would immediately tell you that they belonged to a denomination that was governed by presbyteries. If they said they were Congregationalists, you would know they belonged to a denomination that gave a great deal of independence to each congregation. And if they said they were Baptists, you would know that they had a particular doctrine of baptism. But if they say they're Methodists, what on earth does it tell you? The Methodist Church shares with the Quaker community the distinction of being the only two denominations in this country where their names began as terms of derision. It was when George Fox, the founder of the Religious Society of Friends, was hailed before an English court for conducting an improper meeting, that is to say, a meeting that was not authorized by the Church of England. He told the judge that he should not really interfere in what Fox was doing, but quake and tremble before the presence of the Lord, hence the nickname Quakers. Now, for Methodists, we've got to look a little more closely. And I'm going to begin, in a way, in the rectory at Epworth, where the rector was one Samuel Wesley, who lived there with his wife, Susanna, and their children. They had 19. I'm sure you ladies have a certain sympathy with Susanna Wesley. Out of their 19, only 10 lived to maturity, 3 boys and 7 girls. The 3 boys, another Samuel, John and Charles, successively went to Christ Church in Oxford, to Christ Church College, and duly graduated. John became a fellow of Lincoln College, because of course Epworth was in Lincolnshire. When Charles, the last of the 3, got to Christ Church, John was away on leave. His father had a second parish linked to Epworth, a little place called Root, and John was helping him as curate of Root for a while, until the university said, come back and get on with the job of tutoring as a fellow should. So John came back. He found that Charles had gathered a number of friends who were meeting about once a week in a room in Christ Church College to study the Bible. John, as the elder and as a tutor in the university, became the leader of this little group. They studied the Bible. They read the works of the Christian fathers of the first 2 centuries. And they studied the prayer book rather more closely than most people did in those days. For not only did they go to worship with their prayer books, but they observed all the feasts of the church and all its fasts, which included every Friday in the week. And they performed the works of charity. They visited the sick and the poor. They visited prisoners in prison. They visited debtors in prison. In those days, if you owed money, you could be put in prison until you paid it. Once it was paid, whether by you or someone else, you were free to go. But in the meantime, there you were in prison. And it was this regular observance of the rules of the church that got at the Oxford students. The little group that John and Charles were leading varied in its membership from time to time, but most of the meetings would have had only about 7 at any given time. The Oxford students were not particularly sympathetic to religion. Students very seldom are. And they began to produce jeering names for the little group. The Methodists have tended since to refer to that little group as the Holy Club, which was one of the nicknames, and that distinguishes them from the rest of us who use the term Methodist. Bible moth suggests that the little group chewed through the Bible, leaving holes in it the way a moth did in cloth. But the one that has stuck was Methodist. They were suggesting that for salvation, this little group depended not on divine grace, not on faith, but on method, on a methodical way of doing religion, performing all the rules regularly. And that is the origin of the name Methodist, as far as we are concerned. When Wesley began his evangelistic work in England, he chose to use the name that was once a sneer and that became a name of respect. In one of his comic operas, Gilbert has a character called Robin Oakapple, who is supposed to be the absolute perfection of a hero. So he is described as combining the manners of a marquis with the morals of a Methodist. Can you think of anything better than that? While Wesley, this may seem like a diversion, but you'll see the point of it in the course of time. John Wesley was in Oxford, he fell in love. He fell in love with Sally Kirkham, whose father was a rector in Gloucestershire. And John and some of his friends would go down to that area so that they could do a little bit of courting with one or other of the ladies in the area. And John became greatly enamoured of Sally Kirkham, but John's first concern always, as early as this, was to do the will of God. So the first thing he had to do was to ask God, as a priest of the Church of England, was it right for him to get married, or should he remain celibate? And by the time God answered, yes, it's all right to marry, there was another question that John wanted to ask. Is Sally the right one? And when he reckoned that God had said yes to that, off he went down to Gloucester to propose and found that she hadn't waited. She'd got engaged to somebody else. So he transferred his affections to one of her friends, charming little widow, very young widow, called Mary Pendarves. And he began to make advances to Mary Pendarves, who promptly choked him off because she may have liked him as a friend, but certainly wasn't going to hitch her life to the man she referred to, not very complimentarily, as little primitive Christianity. She took herself off to Dublin, where she eventually married Dr. Pat Delaney, and as the famous Mary Delaney, lived with her husband at Delville in Glasnevin. The site is now occupied by the Bon Secours Hospital. A very famous, very fine woman, but not given to little primitive Christianity. That was the point at which John had a bright idea. The effort to form an ideal Christian community in Oxford had failed. There was too much else to conflict. They were opening a new world on the other side of the Atlantic. Now, wasn't that the ideal place in which to start a perfect Christian community with the innocent natives of America? So he would go out as a missionary to the Indians. And he persuaded Charles and a couple of others to come with him. And off they went on board the Simmons. They were going to Georgia, now the state of Georgia, but then a colony led by General Oglethorpe, with its capital at Savannah. And from there, John would set out among the Red Indians to establish the ideal Christian community. There was a storm on the way over, and it looked very much as if the Simmons was going to go down. John was terrified. He could not face the thought of death. He could not face the thought of what would happen beyond death when he came before the judgment seat of God. And he was bewitched, bewildered by a group of Moravians on board, men, women, and children, who didn't seem to be worried at all. They continued to say their prayers, they continued to sing their hymns, and they didn't seem to be worried if the ship went down in the next hour. John said to one of the men, "Are your children not afraid to die?" And the man replied, "No, none of us are afraid to die, not even our children." Nobody died. The ship survived, arrived in Georgia, and they came into Savannah. And John made it his business to talk to the Moravian pastor, August Spangenberg, almost as soon as he arrived. From that conversation, he came away with the conviction that he had no real Christian faith. But it's interesting to read Spangenberg's journal, who says that he saw a great deal of faith in Wesley and believed he wasn't far from the kingdom of God. However, in America, two things happened. John fell in love again, inevitably. This time it was Sophie Hopke. And again, the Almighty had to be consulted about marriage and about Sophie. And by the time John got round to proposing to her, she was not only engaged, she was married. So that was another one gone. And rows broke out in Savannah because the colonists were not taken from the highest levels of English society. Some of them were almost the offscouring of the English jails. Most of them were people who had failed to make a living in England and were hoping that in the new land they would be able to be different, but they weren't. They took their troubles with them, particularly two women, a Mrs. Walsh and a Mrs. Hawkins, who had a great weakness for gossip, and particularly salacious gossip, and made endless trouble in Savannah. And poor John was supposed to cope with them. And Oglethorpe reckoned that he was so busy coping with the colonists that he really had no time for the Choctaw, the local Indian tribe. John never saw one of them. There is a celebrated painting of Charles Wesley preaching to the Choctaw, but that has no foundation in fact either. It was part of later Methodist mythology. Eventually, in 1738, John came back to England, followed by Charles. Now, I've told you all of that to give you something of the mind of John Wesley as he came back to England and returned to London. He was a man with an acute sense of failure. He had courted three different ladies, and not one of them had been prepared to marry him. On the journey over, he had been called into question his own faith. How was it that other people could face death without fear and he couldn't? And finally, he had gone out on a mission to the Indians and never seen one of them. So he was three times a failure. And when you are in the depths of depression or in a deep sense of failure and the impossibility of life, is very often the moment when the Spirit of God can move in. And on the 24th of May, In 1738, John Wesley went to a little Moravian meeting. There were several Moravian meetings in London at the time. We always call this one the Aldersgate meeting, but in fact it was in a little court, Nettleton Court, off Aldersgate Street. And there he went one evening. And he's very precise. At 9:15 in the evening, as one was reading from Luther's preface to his commentary on the Epistle to the Romans, can you imagine anything less exciting, anything more dry than a learned commentary on a passage of Holy Writ? Not the Holy Writ itself, but a commentary on it. You see, God is very surprising the way he works. It was at that moment that Wesley felt his heart strangely warmed and believed that he was a child of God. We have called it his conversion. That, I think, was because there was a great fashion a few years ago for calling all religious experiences conversion. I'm convinced that John Wesley was converted to Christianity under the ministry of his mother years before this, because she devoted a lot of attention to his religious upbringing. After he was rescued at the age of 6 from a fire in the rectory, when they actually had to make a pyramid of men to lift him out of the window and down because the stairs were ablaze, she felt that God had something special for this child. And I believe that it was in that process that John made his commitment to God. And what came to him in Aldersgate Street or in Nettleton Court, I believe, was the sense of assurance. And it is from that date that many people think to date the origins of the Methodist Church, but they were not. Wesley and Charles continued to go to the Methodists, to the Moravians, this time to a meeting in Fetter Lane. And for 12 months, there was no sign of any breakaway. Two things changed the situation. One was that the Methodist group, the Moravian group, began to think in terms of what is known as quietism. The idea that you had to wait for God before you did anything. There was no point in praying. There was no point in praising God. There was no great point in reading the scripture until God's Spirit moved you. And Wesley was not prepared to accept that. He preferred the words of Peter Burla, one of the Moravian leaders, who told Wesley, preach faith until you have it, and then because you preach faith, you will have it. And I think Wesley was right in believing that you don't wait for the Spirit doing nothing. You are active. You go to meet him, knowing that he is seeking you. John was the activist. But there was another reason. One of the members of the Holy Club had been George Whitfield. George had become an evangelistic preacher. He had become a Calvinist, which was why he never really linked up with the Methodists, though he was in and out of relationship with Methodist work from time to time. But at the moment in 1838, he was working among the miners of Bristol. But George Whitfield was haunted. He was haunted by the hills and the corners. On the far side of that hill were people who perhaps hadn't heard the gospel. Around the corner, there were possibly many people who had never come into contact with Christ in any living way. And George was determined to go on and to try and reach that lot. What did he do with the folk to whom he had been preaching? Generally, he left them to look after themselves, and generally, they evaporated. As he said at the end of his life, "I was weaving a rope of sand." Commentators have said that if John Wesley converted his thousands, Whitfield converted his tens of thousands. Possibly true. But so little work remained because Whitfield was always going on to somewhere else. He did think to try and do something about these miners in Bristol. He asked John Wesley if he'd come down and have a look at them and perhaps take over. And John went down to Bristol and discovered that Whitfield was preaching in the open air. Horror of horrors. The proper place for preaching was in church, wasn't it? However, in Wesley's own language, one day he consented to be more vile and went out to Hammam Mount and stood on a little eminence there and preached to the miners of the area. And he was astonished at the response. It was that convinced John that there were thousands of people in England whom the church could never reach if it wanted them to come into church, because they wouldn't go. If you wanted to go to church on Sunday, you had to put on your Sunday suit and your Sunday dress. And these working class people, these artisans, these craftsmen, had no Sunday dress, no Sunday suit to put on. They could imagine of the nice people in church if they suddenly appeared in their grubbiness. The only way to reach them was to go where they were. And that is the origin of a Methodist tradition that lasted until my lifetime, of preaching wherever people could be gathered, at the Market Cross, in the Market Hall, in the law court, on a street corner, in a field, at a crossroads, in a barn, anywhere that a crowd could be assembled. There you preached them, and there they responded. And when they joined the Methodist Society, it was probably in a barn that they continued to worship. I have been in one or two of them around Ireland. They are no longer Methodist chapels, but you know, they were at one time, having originally been barns. And that was then when Wesley began his work. In 1739, he and Charles led a number of people to the foundry in Moorfields, where armaments had been made, but which was now vacant, and they turned it into the first Methodist chapel in London. They also had a group meeting in Bristol, and on these two, Methodism began and began to spread. But hold on a minute. How many educated people were there who could control these crowds? Were they to disappear like Whitfield's rope of sand? Wesley was an organizing genius. If these groups were to survive, and Wesley didn't want them to be a separate denomination, he wanted them to be a group of enthusiasts within the English church. And that, by the way, has an interesting background as well. Because in the 17th century, England went to war with itself. We call it the Cromwellian Wars, when a parliamentary army on the one hand and a royalist army on the other fought at places like Edgehill, Naseby, and others. And what was so awful about that was that you found brother fighting against brother, cousin against cousin. Families were riven by the conflict. And the English decided they never wanted that in England again. The result was the cult of reason. The 18th century is called the Age of Reason. You did things reasonably. You didn't do things enthusiastically. Enthusiasm was dangerous. But there were in parishes around England godly rectors who continued to foster the enthusiasm of men and women for their faith. And by the second quarter of the 18th century, societies were forming in the cities to encourage people in enthusiastic faith. Sometimes there would be as many as 50, sometimes fewer. But because they didn't try to reach out, these groups gradually dwindled and disappeared. Why did Wesley's groups continue? Why are we talking today about more than 70 million Methodists throughout the world? Because, as I say, Wesley had a genius for organization. If these work people, these miners, these farmers, these laborers, these artisans were to be held together, they would have to run their own show. And where would they get the ability to do that? Wesley took the class system from the Moravians. He took the quarterly meetings from the Quakers. And he organized them into circuits with preachers going round regularly, not ordained men, laymen. Wesley didn't ordain until very late in his life. But going round, keeping an eye on the societies, but they had to exist in the meantime, on their own, with their own. The preacher stationed in Castle Bar in Wesley's lifetime took 6 weeks to do the round of the circuit. So, you know, there were 6 weeks in which they had to do their own thing. How did they do it? This is not a very old book. It's younger than I am. It was the Manual of Laws of the Methodist Church in Ireland, published in 1934. And it still has the sort of questions that Wesley put on the agenda of the circuit quarterly meeting. Question one. What is the account of income and expenditure for the last completed quarter? Question two. What is the estimated income and expenditure for the current quarter? Question four. How shall the amount of the poor's fund be allocated? Question five. What are the statistics of membership? Question 6. Do we make any appointments or suggest any arrangements in relation to local preachers in this circuit? Question 7. What is the state of the work of God in this circuit? With a list of questions as simple and straightforward as that, it's very hard to go wrong, isn't it? If you are prepared to give them honest answers, that is the basis on which people with very little education could run the growing organization of Methodist societies and could learn how to take that sort of organization into other places. And we'll come to that at a later stage. And that is why Methodism grew. And that is why Methodism survived, because Wesley had given them the means by which to do it. William Hartpole Lecky, one of the great Irish historians of a previous age, reckoned that it was John Wesley and his Methodists who saved England from the sort of bloody revolution that they had in France. There were moments in England when the revolution looked pretty dangerous. The Peterloo massacre, the Gordon riots, the Tolpuddle martyrs. They were moments of tension, moments of difficulty, but no bloodshed as they saw in Paris and elsewhere in France. No slaughtering of the aristocracy and the gentry. But the revolution took place nonetheless. And in part it took place because John Wesley and his Methodists, with something as simple as that, had provided a way in which working people, working class people, if you will, could express their problems, their frustrations, and their wishes to the point where England had to take notice. Thank God for that sort of change.